Welcome. I'd like to call order Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee, and if we could have somebody approve the minutes. Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the minutes.
And all approve, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well, welcome, Chairman Nornes. Would you introduce yourself to your committee? And
Representative Nornes?
Nornes, yes.
Did I do it right?
Welcome to the committee, your committee.
I'd like to move House File 821 and recommend it to pass and be placed on the general register.
Representative Nornes moves House File 821, and that would be approved and to sent to the general register. All in favor?
Okay. You probably want to talk about it first.
We'll talk about it first,
yes. I've got to convince a couple of people first.
Okay.
So, and this won't take long, I don't think. Okay. For those of you where this is a new issue, for at least the those new on this committee, the Senior Citizens Higher Education Program allows senior citizens to take courses offered at our public institutions wherever space is available, and after all tuition-paying students have been accounted for. If taken for credit, the senior citizen must pay an administrative fee in an amount established by the governing board of the institution to cover the costs, but no administration fees are charged to seniors who are auditing a course. This was changed last year. It's, I think, important for lifelong learning for one reason that we're talking about it today. Last year, the age when a senior citizen was eligible to take part in this was changed from 62 to 66. And so I don't recall a lot of debate at the time that we did that, made that change, but it was part of the larger, not sure if it was part of the omnibus bill, maybe Brooke Kavina can recall, but I think it was. And there were some people that were kind of caught who were taking courses, and we have an example of that with us today, who got caught in that age change. And so we're trying to, with this bill, return it back to age 62. And I'd like to, at this time, have my witness tell his story. His name is Ken Kastner.
Yes.
If you identify yourself for the
record. Welcome, Mr. Kastner. Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Ken Kastner, and I appreciate this opportunity. I'm an out-of-work senior citizen, age 64. I was laid off as a result of the bad economy. I initially collected unemployment when I realized that a then 62-year-old man would find it almost impossible to get a job. I applied for and am receiving early Social Security benefits. In an attempt to better myself and further my computer knowledge, I started taking classes at St. Paul College to attain a web design certificate on the Senior Tuition Discount Program. I attended classes from spring of 2009 to the spring of 2010 at the reduced senior rate. As you know, this is on a when space is available basis. I have 25 credits toward my web design certificate with a GPA of 4.0. In May of 2010, I received an email from my school telling me that the minimum requirement had been changed from 62 years old to 66 years old. The explanation from the college was that the law was changed because the program was only designed for supplemental classes, not to attain any kind of a degree. I have since been told that it was a result of budget constraints. I don't understand. I'm only allowed to register after all other students are registered. The seat would be empty were I not in it, and by definition, the $20 plus fees was to cover the expenses of the college. Since our state does not supplement the school for my being in the seat, the school is collecting for expenses, where is the extra cost? From the fall of 2009 through the spring of 2010, I incurred $1,093 in school tuition and related expenses, not counting books. I believe that there were about 285 seniors statewide using the program. If I am typical, that comes to a possible revenue loss to Minsky of $300,000. I may or may not be typical, nonetheless, but it is a loss of revenue. Being that neither my wife, nor Diane, or myself are working, we have decided that paying full tuition is not affordable. I believe most seniors to be in a similar situation. I did not attend college in the fall of 2010 semester. I did take two continuing ed online classes at $95 each, pass, no pass, for no credit. It was suggested to me that I apply for a FAFSA grant. I decided against that as I could possibly be taking money away from a young person who needed it more than I. Please reinstate the program. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Pulaski.
Excuse me. Go ahead. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can you explain your motion to send this to the floor rather than for possible inclusion in the higher ed bill? The fiscal note seems a little confusing, but why is this going to the floor rather than going through a fiscal omnibus bill?
Chairman Norris?
Well, it doesn't, as far as I can tell, it doesn't have any fiscal impact. The note we show, there is really virtually none.
Well,
and it's just a decision to send it to the floor.
Well, Mr.
Representative Pulaski,
I'm looking at the fiscal note, and maybe Mr. Berg can explain it. Can you explain the fiscal note on this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I was just talking to Representative Morrow about it. You have in your packet a fiscal note. The front page of the fiscal note shows zero impact to the state. And what that means is there is no net costs or savings to the state of Minnesota. Now, if you go further in, you'll see each system has a narrative, and they can currently identify students who are between the ages of 62 and 66 who are in school now paying tuition. And that gives you a number, I think, for Minsky of about 215,000, and the U's is somewhere in the 400,000 range. Both systems further state that there's no cost to filling an empty seat. There is no cost to them and no impact to the state. There is an assessment that they may lose some tuition they're getting now, but they're able to absorb that within their operations. And so from the state's perspective, there's no cost to this.
All right. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Berg, but I want to continue just with Representative Norris for a second. My question, though, even still stands. Why are we sending one higher ed bill to the floor all by itself and others for possible inclusion? Can you explain the criteria of how some bills are going to be included in your omnibus bills and others are going to the floor?
Representative Ornis.
Trying to remember. We haven't had that many bills, Representative.
Mr. Representative Ornis, that's my point.
It was just a decision that I felt this could go to the floor, and rather than get it involved with a much larger omnibus bill, I'd like to pass the bill on the floor this year, and maybe that's the best reason.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, would this bill be amenable to other higher ed amendments on the floor?
Perhaps.
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 Perhaps it will.
Yeah, you know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, I do, and we're sort of cautioned about opening up entire areas of our accounts, budgets on the floor, particularly in these tough fiscal times. That's not a question.
I understand. Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we just have to trust one another.
Representative Norris, I think at $5.2 billion, I'm not trusting anyone this session.
I understand.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, along several lines. So you're anticipating maybe that your first higher ed bill gets vetoed and then you've got to come up with a compromise and this is the vehicle for it? Or? I'm curious as to why this is going on.
You could make an assumption, Representative Rukavina. I mean,
Mr. Chair, perhaps if Representative Poppe would help me out, this was in the omnibus bill, and we did have some discussion about it in committee. I recall we had some significant discussion about it. In fact, and so Representative Poppe, can you just refresh my memory as to? I mean, I think if I remember some of the discussion, it was about we're cutting other programs, the students are picking up extra, and, you know, it's nice that you went back to school, learned computer. I'm not only a dinosaur when it comes to computers, sir, I'm like a one-celled amoeba, but that's beside the point. you know, I'm glad you went back, but, you know, a lot of the students in the room, if I see any, I mean, they're picking up a lot of extra payments. And so please just refresh my memory, if you could.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ruka, being that, yes, it was a part of a comprehensive Minsky bill that I authored. And I would say that this being a small part, in my mind, to recoup costs and add fairness. Certainly, we have a number of students who, at age 42 or 52 or 22, would be able to, you know, would like to be able to pay the lowest cost they could for their college credits. But it seemed as though, if we're trying to cut costs and do what we can to allow our students who are going through the process to pay a fair amount for their education, that this was one way to do it. There are certainly other aspects of that bill that I would have preferred to have gotten through the process, and one being the fact that we pay through the Board of Trustees. There's a bonus aspect to Minsky administrators that receive a bonus, and I'd say that also is something that dramatically impacts our students and the costs they're paying, and that was something I would have liked to have seen go through and may in the future have an opportunity to do that. But this was an aspect of trying to control costs, recoup the costs, add fairness to the system.
Representative Nornes, any comment? Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to be picking up on the same theme. I see that at 1:30 today, Representative Rukavina, we're going to be hearing House targets for each committee. I know that the Senate had a target of cutting $486 million out of higher education. So, Representative Nornes, I suppose my question that I'm leading up to you is, I think, you know, part of me says this is great. And, sir, I certainly have no issue with your situation. Of course, I think I remember that we had a young woman up here who has a child who's working three jobs and who's paying tuition and whose tuition is going to go up. So it seems like we're making a qualitative judgment here. She would probably say, I would love to be taking courses. I think she was in Faribault for free on a space available basis. Sir, if I could just finish. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Norris, my question to you is this. Why are we sending one budget item that costs the systems combined approximately $850,000 over the biennium? Why don't we hold that and include that in the entire budget discussion for higher education?
Representative Nornes.
Well, you could make a motion to do that, I suppose, if you wanted to.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Nornes, you know, I heard on the House floor, especially in the last 2 years, you hold the gavels. If you want me to have the gavel, I will make those decisions. But, sir, you hold the gavel.
I do.
And so my question is, as the chair of this committee, I'm trying to understand why one budget item that starts to come close to $1 million is being sent to the floor when we haven't even had a discussion in here about your budget target for this committee for all of higher education. And we can have the discussion of whether we believe that this population should be able to go tuition-free or whether the person with three jobs and a kid should be able to go tuition-free. So I'm asking you for an explanation of the process.
Representative Nornes.
Well, I didn't hear Mr. Burke talk about $1 million unless I missed that.
Representative Nornes, if I might, Mr. Chair, and I will explain. It was $215,000 per year, so it's $430,000 for the biennium for Minsky, and it was $434,000 for the University of Minnesota in lost tuition. He didn't say there was an expenditure. He didn't say they changed the state appropriation. What it does is it changes the bottom line for the institutions themselves. So to them, it is a revenue loss. And I'm asking you as chair of this committee, as we're trying to put together a budget that doesn't whack nearing 9 to 10,000 course sections. It doesn't eliminate so many professors. How we get to sending one bill to the floor for this one issue, in light of the fact that we're going to be getting budget targets for this committee in 42 minutes.
Any other comments, Representative Nornes?
Well, I guess.
Representative Benson.
Go ahead.
I'd like to see a roll call on this.
There hasn't been a motion yet.
There hasn't been a motion yet, no.
Yeah.
Well, there's a motion.
There was a motion to move.
Yes. Yeah.
To the floor.
Yes, there was.
That is the motion. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I guess what I'm contemplating is maybe changing the motion to possible inclusion.
That he can do that if he wants.
The motion has been moved and second. That
I haven't. I was thinking out loud.
Okay.
Well,
think away.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're kind of getting way off base on this. For one, all due respect, Representative Morrow, I believe Mr. Berg said it doesn't have a cost impact. It's only if a chair is empty that this person is able to take the course. So the lost revenue is really not lost revenue because there is nobody taking that course in that chair. So the senior citizen who is sitting in the class, although he is getting it able to be there for free, there is nobody paying, would be anybody there paying for that chair. So to me, it's a moot point. It's the universities would not get that tuition anyway because there would be nobody there. So.
Okay, I have a question. Is it my understanding then that those senior citizens can only be seated if there's an open seat? Is that my understanding?
That is correct.
Is that correct? Okay. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, and that may be, but we've heard testimony from the systems, both the university and the Minsky system. We've heard testimony from the students and from the faculty that they're going to be combining, having larger class sizes. You know, nobody can sit in a classroom where the lights aren't turned on or the bathrooms aren't cleaned or other expenses like that incur. And the point being that, you know, it was kind of thought that maybe we should ramp that age group up a little bit because people were going there to not get a degree but to just do things, as this gentleman said, to, you know, take a course to learn how to operate the computer better or whatever. There's still the expenses there. We're in a huge budget crisis. I hope that Representative Nornes's target isn't as bad as what we saw come out of the Senate, but you know, it's just not fair that you know, single mom that has three kids and is working three jobs got to pay the way for seniors who maybe are on a pension or Social Security already and are going to the classroom to try to get a skill that they may or may, you know, they may need. But regardless, it is just not fair given this budget crisis that we're now taking another $800,000 away from the systems.
Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Representative Vogel, we can go back and forth. I'm just reading off their fiscal note of what they say their expenditures would be. Mr. Chair, I know that we were talking right before about not hitting you with a tough procedural question, but I have a procedural question. I would like to move to amend the motion to not send this to the General Register, but rather to lay this over for possible inclusion. Can I make that motion, or do I have to do this as a separate motion? I defer to you. I don't know how.
You can amend the motion.
Okay. I believe we have to vote down the motion.
No. Mr. Chair, Mr. Valu, I think you can amend a motion. The motion was that it be passed and sent to the floor, and the amendment, you can make an amendment. You can't make an amendment to the amendment. The amendment can be that you lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and I think that's a fair thing to do here. I have no problem with the idea, but let's look at what we're going to be faced with here in the next hour or so before we let this go out of here. That's all.
Okay, Representative Arnes.
Okay, I think at this point I would change my motion to simply lay the bill over. And that probably doesn't require, does that require a vote? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. No.
Does not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Arnes has changed his motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
There are some students that have joined us. Do you want me to introduce them?
Yes, Representative Dornis.
I believe they're ninth graders from St. Louis Park High School. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay, you want to raise your hands?
Yes.
And we'll... We want to welcome you here and enjoy the committee. I was going to say sure, but the committee.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say one last thing, I guess, on this issue. You know, I understand, Representative Rukavina, that the single mom with three kids paying tuition is tough, but we have a senior citizen here who has paid taxes for 40-plus years, who has supported this the school systems with their tax dollars, and now at the end of their life, they're, you know, the end of their career, where in this... Not necessarily their life. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Mr.
Are you making
the,
a motion?
End of the road.
If that's in the bill, I'm out.
At the end of their career, I meant to say at the end of their career, they lose their job. So they want to go back and try to better themselves. I think we owe them a little bit of something for the 40-plus years that they've given to paying taxes to support these schools. Over all this time, and to allow them to sit in an empty seat, I think is not a bad deal.
Representative Poppy, and then also if there's anybody in the audience that from Menskew or for the University of Minnesota that would like to comment on the bill, they could come up also. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I mentioned, this is a bill that I introduced in the last biennium, and it was part of many other aspects to try to reduce costs and to improve the education for our higher education for all of our students. But as Representative Vogel wants to point out, Mr. Kastner is the face of what we are facing when it comes to a budget deficit, when it comes to trying to determine how we're going to balance our budget, and when we're going to do it, as you just mentioned, Representative Nornison introduced, the ninth graders who are sitting here are also the face of future cuts, and perhaps cuts that will be coming within this year. As I look at their faces, and I'm concerned about how they're going to be able to afford higher education, because we're all going to benefit from what they bring to our future economy, I don't do it to dismiss what Mr. Kastner is doing, but I think it was part of the reality that we have a very large budget deficit. We have to try to cut our costs, do what we can to transform the system. This was one of those efforts to be able to do that, and I think that as much as I might admire Mr. Kastner for what he has done to come back to school to try to gain some greater skills, I also am looking at the faces of these ninth graders, and I'm concerned about the future of higher education.
Okay, is there anybody from the University of Minnesota or Menskew that would like to make comment? If not, Representative Banyan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to ask Mr. Kastner a question. At what point could you get a seat in the class? How late did you have to register?
Everyone else had to have been registered. And the registration for everybody else was basically closed.
So, but was it before the start of the semester? Was it the first day of semester?
Generally, I would have to miss the first class or two or even week if it was an online class.
Okay.
So I would miss those classes, and then I would have to catch up.
So the lights are on, the students are in the room, the professor is already lecturing?
Correct.
Okay, so, and then if you want to do it then to get that empty seat in the room, you had to pay.
Well, I don't know if I paid for it.
You did it, but.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I understood that.
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, didn't follow protocol, excuse me. But yeah. Thank you, that's the only point I want to make.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, too, echo a lot of what my colleagues have said. I think it's great that you go back, and when we discussed this bill, Mr. Chair and members, last year, it's not done lightly. It's in looking toward the future, and I've just been sitting through healthcare meetings. A couple other of you sit on that committee, and we've talking about the tsunami of retirees that are coming in the next few years, and that's really what this bill a year ago was looking at, is that we are having more and more people reaching retirement age, and I wondered, my question really is for Mr. Berg over there, are these projections only go 2 years out, but do they would they be adjusted based on demographic changes?
Mr. Burke?
Or what's the basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, all they represent is the money that can be identified now that's being collected straight line forward. There isn't any assumption in there of in the future there would be twice as many people who would have qualified who now don't. There's nothing like, it's just the number they can identify now going forward. And you can easily theorize whether that number would be right, higher or lower in the future under a different set of circumstances.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norris, I do want to thank you for laying the bill over, because I do think we have to have a full budget discussion about all the things that we're going to decide in this committee and this chamber that will affect higher ed. So I thank you very much for laying it over.
Are there any other questions or comments? Representative Norris?
Just thank you for the discussion, and we'll move forward.
Might I add something or ask a question? Would anybody know if the seniors that were involved in this program as of the 62-year-old age, have they come back into the 60s and paid full tuition? And if that didn't happen, does that not lead me to believe that they actually a loss of revenue instead of a gain of revenue? Because they're not showing up.
Mr. Berg, do you have an answer for that?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question off the top of my head, I don't think. I will say I had a conversation with Ms. Borgen at Minsky this morning generally about this, and of interest, we were noting there are some folks who would qualify for tuition who currently pay the full price by evidently their own choice for a reason that we don't know necessarily. Possibly they don't want to disclose their age. Possibly they want to be insured that they get a seat in a class that otherwise maybe would not have an open seat. So we do know there are people now who would qualify for free tuition who choose not to take it.
Thank you. I think the motion, we made the motion earlier to lay this bill over.
The motion been made to... 21. To lead to have the motion laid over for possible inclusion. All in favor? No vote.
Okay.
Just it will be laid over.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Next up is House 440. Representative Norton, would you introduce yourself and move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 40. I think it has to be approved and go to whatever the Workforce Committee is on Workforce.
Okay, Representative Norton moves, sir, that House 440 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee of Jobs and Economic and Development.
Thank you. Well, I'm pleased to bring forward this bill, and I don't know if our the gentleman that was here before might be interested in this, because this is a bill that actually does help to address employees having an ability to have some funds set aside for future education. They're called LILA accounts, lifelong learning accounts. They are employer-matched, in this particular bill, portable individual accounts similar to 529s that many of you might have for your children or have heard about, that allow money to be set aside for education and retraining for an employee. I have been thinking about this quite a bit given the economy and what's happened during this recession, because if these accounts had been in play for employees and employers over the years during this recession, we would have had an easier time, I think, getting some of those unemployed folks back into school, because they would have had these accounts to tap into. It's kind of a co-investment strategy. As I said, they're portable. The accounts are for the training are pretty broad in scope. There is a tax credit in the bill for the individual, I'll get to the cost of this in just a moment. There is also a tax credit for the employer, should they choose to match. Those do have caps on them. They're limited. They are targeted for high occupational openings in the areas of industry growth, and I think These are it's an option. They've been discussed both federally and across in states across the nation. We have not necessarily been key on tax credits of late here in the House, although it did have an informational session last year. It wasn't moved forward, but it's generally bipartisanly supported. And I did want to just mention the cost of this. There will be no cost. In fact, higher education, the institutions themselves would benefit from this because it would have money flowing into the colleges. So from the higher ed perspective, there will be actually a cost benefit to these eventually. The tax credit, however, will cost the budget, and that has to be dealt with. And that's why I'm moving to workforce through Deed, who did speak positively about this a year ago. And then it'll go to taxes, where, of course, the issue of tax credits will be thoroughly discussed this year, I have no doubt. I'd be happy to answer questions on this. I think, for me, this was an issue as we look at the needs of our workforce, the changing issues, particularly with technology. You might be in a job, the job changes, or the job is shut down and a new opportunity arises and you need to be trained and educated for that new opportunity. And we know employers, we used to say, would have 7 jobs in a lifetime. Recently I saw it up over a dozen. Extra education, whether it be short-term or perhaps a higher degree, are going to be necessary for more and more of our employers. Minnesota is a highly educated state, which is fun. I have some of the numbers here. Minnesota ranks very well and very low in some areas and high in others, but high school graduates, we rank very high in the country if you look at the states across the spectrum. But we also know that there are many people who start college and don't finish. This also would apply to those folks, that they would be able to finish their education at some point along their work career as well and better themselves. I'm going to close, and I'll just answer questions if you have them, because I know this is just the first stop for this bill. I think we always see educating our young people as a public good, but we often talk about educating adults as a private good. And I would say I'm not certain that's true. I think both our young and our old deserve an education, and we know it will benefit our state's economy the more people, whether they be young or old, that get educated. And we certainly talk about that here in this committee quite often with regard to MNSCU and some of the retraining efforts that they have been undertaking for us. So if you have particular questions about the bill, I'll invite Deed along, because this was kind of a brief stop and it's not affecting you financially. I didn't line up testifiers this morning, or this afternoon, I guess. But I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Members, any questions? Representative Dipke?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting idea. But you said the Commission of Deed will certify trustees or custodians for these accounts. Mm-hmm. Could you give me an example of a trustee or custodian? What type of, would it be a bank, for instance? That's the first thing that came to mind, if they identified certain banks that would keep the account, or would it be within the companies that want to train there?
You don't believe it's within the companies?
No.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and I don't have the complete data on that, but it would be the lifelong learning accounts are one example, and we also in Minnesota has a successful IDA accounts, individual development accounts, which also are well positioned to take on the LILA accounts. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you would define these entities that do it. I don't have the details, but we already have both the 529 accounts and the IDA process or procedure in place that this would slip into, and as I understand it, according to Deed, fairly easily.
Yeah, I am familiar with 529. So the accounts would be then in the name of the individual that is saving for this particular event.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Representative Dipke. Yes, it would. There is a penalty if you withdraw the money and use it for something other than education.
Yes.
If you leave it in there and use it for educational purposes, of course, you put it in pre-tax and you'll get the credit as well as you move along. But that would just go to the institution and be paid out and not be taxed at that time. There was some discussion. I will tell you, I worked on this with Jennifer Loon and Representative Kahn a year ago. Representative Loon, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We worked on this and talked about the possibility of transferring the money to another family member, and that isn't in this bill at this time, but if folks were interested in that, right now we've just focused on the worker, the employer themselves. Mm-hmm. I can tell you a couple years ago when Representative Paulson was here and Representative Kelleher, they co-authored a bill similar to this, and they brought in IBM, and which is a business for my community, and they have these types of accounts already without having the tax credits, but they do try to support their employees and are very supportive of this type of effort because they understand the importance of retraining their own employees, mm-hmm. although in these times of layoffs, they may not be able to retain that employee. They may be training them for another job.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norton, mm-hmm. I understand there's no fiscal note yet ready, and that's certainly fine. That doesn't bother me too terrible much, but I am worried, not worried, but you just mentioned the fact that IBM has a program like this in place. There are other employers who probably have programs like this in place. How many of them exist? Have you done a scan of how many of them exist and whether or not this is going to be, in essence, a replacement for some of those? What's the net effect of this going to be relative to the existing tuition assistance programs that businesses have?
Representative Norton.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a number. I do recall, and this is testimony back, again, when Representative Paulson and Representative Kelleher had the bill, there aren't very many businesses that have these. There are some. IBM being one of them, and the businesses that tended to have it are ones that are across multiple states, and in fact, IBM is international, of course. But they're not well advertised, and if you look through the bill, one of the things that we ask of the commissioner, and again, this may require a small appropriation, is to help them get the information out, so not only that there is a credit available to the employee, and that this option is available to employees, but it would also be, education for employers because, as I recall, there weren't many in the state of Minnesota. I can't speak nationally. I do know this particular type of account is being done nationwide and, as I said, is being talked about federally.
Representative Bennion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norton, that's helpful for me. If there are not that many of these out here, that's helpful. I mean, I'm always concerned, it sounds like a great idea, but I don't know how much it costs, and I don't know what it's replacing compared to what else is going on out there. But that last statement you made, I think, is helpful. Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Benson.
Representative Norton, the bottom of 124.25 talks about encourage both lower-income and lower-skilled healthcare, hospitality, and technology workers. It seems like it's focused primarily on the Rochester area. Is there a reason why it's not more general and broader scoped? So it would include anybody, not necessarily folks in that area?
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. Actually, it wasn't written at all by me for our area. This is a national trend, and I actually went to a conference, a women in government conference, and this is a suggestion that they had due to, and it fits our area well, but these are the areas of growth. And so they were trying to target areas that have many employees that could benefit from retraining within their industry, and this was an area that they identified. It certainly wasn't written for Rochester, but it is, I suppose, would be very helpful to our community.
Representative Benson?
Would you be open to a friendly amendment just to that would say it would be more open so that it would be more inclusive? I just think about the markets around agriculture. I mean, a lot of areas where people might benefit for something like this. I'm thinking of Austin, and the folks down there in
And Mr. Chair,
Norton.
Thank you. Well, certainly I am open to amending the bill. This is not saying others can't have the LILA accounts. What this just was having the Department of Economic Development encourage those particular industries. So I'm certainly willing to broaden the area that they're to encourage. I don't have any problem with that, and I can work with you afterward and put some language in there if you're helpful, but it's not at all meant to target Rochester. I think it's kind of interesting that you picked up on that.
Those happen just to be our three main employers.
Indeed.
So do I take it you're not offering an amendment now? You'll work it out?
We can work together.
Between now and the next stop?
We're from the same part of the state.
Okay. Anyone else have questions? If not, would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to renew my motion that the bill be passed and sent on to the Committee on Workforce and Economic Development.
Jobs and Economic Development.
Jobs and Economic Development. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the change titles changed too often.
It's close enough. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right.
Thank you.
There you go. Next on our agenda, we have from the University of Minnesota a little discussion and presentation on agriculture and extension service and so forth. Welcome to both of you, and whoever is starting, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension and Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station, and I'll let my colleague also introduce himself.
Hi there, I'm Alan Levine. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to both of you.
Mr. Chair, what we'd like to do today is just give you a short overview of the Agricultural State Special, what it is, and also talk about the impact of the special and how we use that special in the state. So many of you know the Agricultural State Special is funding through the Minnesota Higher Ed Bill. It's a line item in the University of Minnesota, and it is dedicated dollars for research and extension at the University of Minnesota. The Agricultural State Special provides the base funding for our faculty that work in agricultural research and extension. We have faculty throughout the state on multiple campuses and at regional and local offices. And they fund, salaries of the experts that respond to the needs of Minnesota agriculture and rural Minnesota. It also provides the operating funds for many of our research, our plant and animal research facilities throughout the state. The Agricultural State Special is also unique and very important to us because it does pay the faculty salaries, and then we're able to leverage those funds to acquire additional research grants and also state, federal, and private funding. It multiplies the impact of the State Special and is able us to meet the large needs that we have throughout the state. To tell you a little bit about how the Ag State Special is divided, that one-third of the Agricultural State Special goes to extension to bring research-based information to the state, and two-thirds of the Ag State Special goes to the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station, and that is used to fund research in five colleges. Other funding sources for extension and the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, which are the two colleges that receive the largest amount of the Ag State Special, is provided by the University of Minnesota, federal government, competitive grants, gifts, and also for extension, a large percent of our funding also comes from local county government. This is just a chart of showing you the funding for extension and the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. You can see that for extension, 24% of the Ag State Special, 24% of our budget is the Ag State Special. 14% is in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. You could also see that the University of Minnesota also provides additional O&M funding in support of the research and extension that we're doing with the Ag State Special. As you can see in both of our colleges, extension and the College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resource Sciences, CFANS I think might be easier if I just go to that, are very important sources of funding for our two colleges to conduct the research and to support our faculty. This just gives you a summary of the funding from Ag State Special from 2002 to 2012-13, or the projected. You can see that the Ag State Special, there's been a couple increases in a couple years, but that Ag State Special has been decreasing, again, in the state funding that's received. As many of you know, that the Agricultural State Special was reduced in FY12 by 12.7%. But I do also then want to emphasize that the University of Minnesota also then provided additional O&M dollars to help support our faculty and also the work that we're doing. That gives you an overview of the funding of the Ag State Special, where it goes, where the funding is, and now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Dean Levine, to talk about the impact of the State Special and to give you examples of how we use the State Special in the state.
You can pause for just a moment. We have a question from Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I just want to go back, if you could, now that you finish the funding part to the slide, Ag State Special Fund. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I understand that in 1989, the funding per biennium was $87 million. You'll see that that the funding is projected in this upcoming biennium to be less than it was over 20 years ago. So I have a question for the testifier. You mentioned, I think, in the last or in this biennium that the University of Minnesota found money to try to shore up a little bit of that. First of all, where did you get that money from? And second, would is the plan to do so again in 2012-2013?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that funding came from the additional funding that the University of Minnesota gets from the state legislature. So that was state funding, operating money that was then directed towards the colleges that received funding from Extension and the Experiment Station. And the question is, from my point of view and from Dean Levine's, I would say I would hope so. But again, as you know, state funding decreases, that there's no assurance that the university will have additional funding to support our work.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe, and maybe this is a Dean Levine question, if your budget is cut 16%, what happens to the state ag special funding?
Dean Levine.
Chair.
Representative Levine.
If the money is targeted and we don't get money to supplement that, then we are in deep trouble. We have to find a way to make up that deficit through other means.
Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question on this slide and a statement you made earlier. You said that this is just state money that you have here, or is this combined with the federal and private grants? Is it just state money on this bar chart?
Dean Durgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is just the state money, the Ag State Special money.
All right, then my question is, when we cut you a dollar, how much do you lose in either private, federal matching money? Is it dollar to dollar? Is it $3? What do you lose besides just this bar chart?
Well, I can address on the research component, Mr. Chair, Representative. On the research component, we a dollar in returns about $2.50 out on research grants. So when we lose that dollar, if we lose faculty, we lose capacity to then obtain research funding outside to help support the needs of the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, then, is that considered a base cut to you when we lower your funding and you lose capacity to get the match? Is that also a base cut? It might not be a base cut this year, but it would be a base cut in the following year because you wouldn't have the money to make the match to get the grants.
Who wants to respond?
Chair, Representative, yes, it is a recurring reduction in our funding.
And, Mr. Chair, maybe you've done it. Is there a slide in the future that shows us that impact? That you could trace how much you've lost in totality now? Not just in state funding, but how much you've lost in either private or federal grants as a result of these reductions?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have a slide included in this, but we can address some of those needs as we go through it.
All right. Mr. Chair, if you could, and I think once we get down to budget numbers, considering you just heard what the Senate did, that would be a very important consideration here, what we are going to lose in federal and private matching when we make these cuts.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, and also Representative, is that one of the reasons that the Ag State Special is so important, as I mentioned, is that it pays our salaries for our faculty. Mm-hmm. And the work of Extension is done by our faculty. So as we cut people, we cut the amount of programs that we can do. So that's a multiplier effect, too, with reduction in people. And I know I can speak for Dean Levine and myself that these reductions in our budget has meant a reduction in our workforce.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pulaski,
I would suggest you make a visit to each of us when you get these numbers in our offices so we can ask questions that aren't consuming everyone's time here, but this is going to be a huge cut to your budget.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you also, I'm sure you didn't bring the stats with you, unless I not looked through this, and they're going to be in the next few slides. There's been a steady decline in your funding. Is that precipitated then into a real-time loss of 2.5 times the dollars? So if I were to look back from 2002 and three biennium that we would actually see that projected in a loss. I guess what I'd like for you to do is provide me then with the chart on where those grant dollars have gone, so that we can. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no more questions, you can proceed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So really, the purpose of using these funds is to supply the base salaries and make certain that we can have a secure and safe supply of food and also feed, fuel, and fiber. That is the intent, in a responsible fashion. And to give you an idea of what can happen, we all know in this room soybeans are pretty important to the economy of this state. So some soybean aphids happened to hitchhike over from Asia to this country on edamame, an edible soy product, or perhaps on buckthorn, where they live. And somehow, part of their life cycle, somehow they got here, and an extension staff noted this in talking to a farmer and then reported it, and we noted that we could have $200 million in annual losses at the state due to this infestation. What then happened was, and also we have the potential to reduce our losses by $1.3 million over 15 years in a study that was done at Michigan State, if in fact we do the research in the proper way and move forward. What happened was our scientists, our extension scientists, and our research scientists in the college made recommendations in terms of how to apply the insecticides, and also did something rather clever. The three of our investigators went over to China, and they knew that there was a stingless wasp over there, and it seemed that the soybeans over there didn't have the problem with the aphids. That's because the stingless wasp kills the aphids. So what they've done, and thanks to a BSL, a biosafety level 2 facility for insect studies that we have at the university that was helped funded through state funding, we were then able to take these organisms and study them and see whether they'd be a potential threat and then release them. They haven't taken hold yet, but we have two other species of this wasp that will be released after we get approval for that, and potentially stop this devastating infestation, and also stop the biocontrol would allow for less spraying. So that gives you an idea of just one issue in our economy. Another one is cold hardy grapes. Many of you in here might enjoy either drinking grape juice or drinking wine. You would like to see cold hardy grapes, and that's one of the areas we've developed 4 varieties of cold hardy grapes that then allows our economy to grow dramatically in the area of wines. And to give you an idea here, the industry in 2007 was at $36 million. I recently went to the cold hardy conference and walked around to many of these wineries, the people that, representing the wineries, and they were telling us how important this was to their economy. So the size of the state industry doubled between 2002 and 2007, and there is potential for more growth as well. And not only in cold hardy grapes do we work, but we're trying to extend the growing season. With the water problems in California, we may become the area that's going to have fruits and vegetables, and we have to extend our growing season, and one way to do that is with hoop houses and things of that sort. So we are working across the economy of agriculture to try to improve the situation. We also train a lot of folks. We had some of the people here who are part of one of these leadership groups, the U-Lead group, but unfortunately they had to leave before we got to sit down here. But we train a lot of folks at various points in their career in order to become leaders in our community and to improve the economy and create new jobs. Many of these organizations you've heard about. Also, I'd like to mention that the growth in interest in the student body has continued to increase in our college. We have more students than we've had before, and they change their interest to some degree, but they're always interested in the agricultural and natural resource sciences. We have a great many transfer students. We have discovery majors, and I can tell you that it's an extremely important part of the workforce. We continually get asked by the community and by the industry to provide more students. They need students that are well-trained in leadership qualities as well as the academic pursuit. And when we surveyed a group of our college students, CFAN students, in 2009, we found a pretty impressive statistic. You wouldn't find this across all of the university, I don't believe. 83% of our students found a job within 6 months of graduating. And 76% of these jobs were related to their majors, and their salary, mean starting salary, was $36,000. I think that's something to write home about. I think it's a very nice statistic. I also wanted to mention, we know all of the various disasters that occur around the state related to agricultural and environmental issues. And with the flooding coming forward, Extension plays an extraordinarily important part in making certain that the community is well educated and there are very well developed websites to deal with these issues so that people can go to them and get information. So I think what we were trying to demonstrate here is the state special makes certain that we can continue to do this extremely important work to both our economy. And just to remind you, Norm Borlaug, who got all three of his degrees here, he did in fact get the Nobel Prize, but for peace. And that's because he was helping provide food for a billion starving people. And we continue to work in that area. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for that presentation. Any questions of the panel?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rucabino.
I really do hope that you can go back and look at that question that Representative Pawlowski asked you, maybe give us a grasp of how really what kind of money we're looking at that we lost. You should have the statistics.
If you want to pull your microphone down a little bit.
To back this up, when we're looking at a 2002-03 appropriation of $113 million approximately, to show what that dropped down to, the 85.7, which I assume was at a 15 or a 20%, were you told to apply what type to that? How did you get at 85.7? Was it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, 12.7%.
12.7, okay. But anyway, I hope we can see that, because I think, as Representative Pawlowski pointed out, it's a lot more significant than what we're looking at here in the numbers. And finally, Mr. Chair,
Rucabino.
And Dean Levine, you know, for what are the other natural resource based training that you do? Because I know we don't have a School of Mines anymore, but does that include silviculture and other things like that?
Mr. Chair. Dean Levine.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, it includes forest resources, it includes wildlife management, it includes fisheries.
No hard rock mining, though, huh?
Not in our college.
But not anywhere anymore at the university, I might add, which is a shame given the significant amount of money we will again contribute this year, about $11.8 million being mined in royalties at Tuat and Taconite this year for the Permian University Fund. So maybe I'll divert that somewhere. I think I got a bill that does that.
Do you?
Chair.
Good.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean, I just, you know, these are, I like the numbers, the second to the last slide, I guess it was. I mean, it's pretty impressive. 83% of the graduates found jobs within 6 months, and those are viable numbers. I hope when you talk to the university, the regents, and those, that they consider that this department is truly viable. I mean, agriculture, you know, the impact that agriculture has on the state of Minnesota is huge. And I hope that the university funds this department more than it funds some of their other departments that don't have quite the impact. And, you know, I mean, we're talking taxpayers that are going out and getting jobs at an average of $36,000. That's great. And I just congratulate you, and I hope the university funds this with, you know, more funds than it does right now. Thank you.
And just for your information, where I come from, agriculture is really the solid part of our economy. It's just one part of it, but it's been the real bedrock. So I think we have some other testifiers on this subject. If you, I believe, anyone in the audience?
Anybody want, Mr. Chair, anybody want to come down and teach us how to make wine or anything like that?
I missed that.
Mr. Chair, committee,
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce Glavin. I represent the Minnesota Wheat Growers, the Minnesota Barley Growers Association, the Minnesota Turkey Growers, and some others. We held an election in the back of the room, and I lost to carry the message on behalf of the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, Jerry Schoenfeld with the Soybean Growers, Corey Bennett with the AgriGrowth Council. Just to give you kind of a common message, and it's very brief on the Ag Special itself, as long as we're hearing that today. Our main message to you really would be to not cut the Ag Special disproportionately to the rest of the university. That happened last year during the unallotment. And the proposal this year in front of you, at least on the O&M as we've read it, is I think the governor's recommending $543 million per year. Last year was 550, and that's a cut of two or three percentage points. But on the Ag Special, last year's bill with Representative Ravina carried was $52 million a year. The new proposal is 42, and that's a cut of 18% versus 2 or 3 on the university as a whole. And I know I was out of the room, but I understand Representative Morrow touched on that. You should also know the growers, through the various councils, use what are called checkoff dollars to do research. That's a 1 penny or a 2 penny tax on every bushel of wheat sold in the state, for example. That money is forwarded to the U for breeding and research purposes, and many of the commodity groups, corn growers, soybean growers, they all do that. Tom and Chris's members from the Bureau and the Union, they also pay that, whether they're members of the wheat growers or not, so they're also involved in that as well. So we want you to know that, in case you don't know that, that the growers actually fund a fair amount of research over there as well. We would remind you, as a group again, that the university was formed as a land-grant institution, and that goes way back into the 1800s. And land-grant university mission was to work with production agriculture. That's why they were formed, in part. And that goes way back, and so we don't want to lose that through the cuts. Final point I'd make involves another area of the special, and that's the health sciences. You'll see 4 or 5 things rolled into the health sciences. One of those is the veterinary diagnostic lab. I know Representative Morrow's already introduced a bill for funding that. We want to make sure that that's not overlooked in the process as well. So, Mr. Chairman, stand for testimony, but that's our stand for questions, but that's our message to the committee today.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming forward. And doesn't appear we have any questions, so again, thank you very much for taking the time. And members, our hearing is adjourned.